Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is a special guest, Mina Markham. Mina Markham is a front-end designer developer in Oakland, California. She contributes to a lot of projects. She's famous for a lot of things, but she's best known, probably, for designing Hillary Clinton's design library pantsuit. With that, hello.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. It's cold in New York. How is it in Oakland?
It's actually kind of cold here, too.
What's going on?
I don't know. At least the sun's out. It's been kind of rainy for the past few days. So
yeah. Here, too. Okay, that's crazy. We're on opposite coasts. We shouldn't be having the same weather. But yeah,
we really shouldn't.
It's sunny today for the first time in 3 days. It just stopped raining. That's crazy.
Wow.
I don't know what to...
That's a little creepy, actually.
Yep. Okay. So you're a STEMinist. It says here on your website at mina.codes, which everybody should check out. Mina.codes is one good place to find you. Mina.codes. It says you're many things. You have this sort of nicely rotating. Is that JavaScript?
That's JavaScript. I have this little rotating, like Mina is, and I substitute a bunch of words in, and some of them are just silly because I was having fun. But cool. STEMinist is, I haven't actually said that in a long time, but STEMinist is essentially it's a feminist who really wants to promote the advancement of women in the STEM fields. It's
science, technology, engineering, and math, right?
In all of those fields, particularly because I am an engineer, although I guess engineering in that sense means more mechanical civil engineering. But still, I always have been more interested and drawn into getting more people like me into the tech field because it just makes everyone better. It makes everything better. So I always try to do what I can to promote the advancement and the inclusion of more people like myself in the field.
Talk about that some more. How did you start? Did you study science first? Did you become a front-end engineer via computer science, or what's your path?
Actually, no. I had, a more non-traditional path, you could say. I don't have any formal training in computer science at all. My formal training is actually as a designer. I have a degree in graphic design from Syracuse University. I went there to study communications and communications design, and that's what I ended up learning while I was there. But towards the last few years of my education there, I wanted to create websites solely for the purpose of putting my design work online. So it was more of a means to an end. I was designing a portfolio site and I was like, well, I don't know how do I get this actually on the internet. So I started Googling and looking up websites and doing the whole view source thing to figure out, well, hey, how'd they do that cool thing there? And so I kind of taught myself everything I know about front-end dev organically. And I realized after doing that for a while that I really enjoyed it. So I made the decision that once I felt I had enough practical skills, I made the transition to be an engineer full time and use my designs background as a supplement.
We have the same story. I'm not an engineer, but we have exactly the same story. I wanted to put my stuff online and I didn't, and there wasn't really any way to do that. And there was, you just had to teach it to yourself. So you've been doing this for a while, obviously.
Yeah, I've been doing it professionally probably for about, I think I made the official transition maybe in 2013. But since I was probably a junior in college, I've been tinkering with the web and with front end and trying to figure out how to create websites.
And if you were just looking to start a portfolio, there are tools, at least today, there are tools out there that, you know, Adobe has a tool, there's Dribbble. There's a million different ways to, people can, WordPress existed. Squarespace might not have when you were in school, but how did you come to just teach yourself anyway? Were the tools just not there, or they weren't what you were looking for?
I think that maybe the tools either weren't there or didn't quite maybe that the barrier to entry was a little too high for me at the time, because I think that well, for one, my first couple of sites were in Flash, so there was that aspect of it where I was learning how to do things in Flash, because that was what the one kind of coding class I took in college was all about Flash. So that was my path that I took there. But I just don't think that I was either aware of or had access to any sort of official instructional things about creating websites. So it was really more of a trial and error process for me. And plus I actually wanted to learn. Like, once I dived into it just a little bit, like, I found it very interesting. So I just used my own portfolio site as a way for me to tinker with and things and play with things.
Cool. Well, I'm self-taught too. When I was in school, the internet existed, but the web did not. So it was a long time ago. But it's amazing how many design programs did not teach anything about the web, and later about application design, UX, and many still kind of don't, which is really surprising. It's almost like it's considered a different thing. But I would think any graphic designer surely in the last 15 years, they should have been taught at least some basics of, you know, HTML, CSS, this is the web, you're going to have clients who need websites, surely. And it's surprising that they didn't. I don't know why that is. I mean, I guess my theory is that schools traditionally are there to teach what's been learned over the centuries, not what's suddenly bursting into life. They, you know what I mean?
Yeah, even when I took that one class, it was the way that they described it was new media. So it was very much like they were unsure about how to go about teaching this new thing. And so they didn't have a lot of options for actual instruction. Like, I don't think even that class I took didn't really teach me how to code. It was more, here's how you make things move around in Flash. So it was, even then, I didn't learn a lot about how to actually program anything.
Now, obviously, not everybody in the world should aspire to your level of skill as a front-end developer, but shouldn't HTML and maybe CSS too be sort of basic skills for anyone who gets an education today, or anyone who's in the job market today, wouldn't you think?
I don't know if I would say it was basic skills for anyone, because I guess I could see that there's instances where people wouldn't necessarily use them. But I think that if you're definitely working in the web at all, then yes, it should be like a base level. You should know how this medium works at its bare minimum. So right. I say that, yeah, if anyone who's working in the web in any capacity should know how to structure good semantic HTML, should know what good scalable CSS looks like, and should know the basics of JavaScript. Like, I think those are the basic building blocks.
Right. I mean, like, you should know about lettering. It doesn't mean you're going to be Jessica Hish or aspire to that level or anything close to it, but just you appreciate it. You understand how it fits into what you do.
Right? Exactly.
It's kind of the same thing.
That's kind of how I could think of it. Like, even if you're like a painter or something, like, you should know how the basic mixing paints to get the pigment you want. Like, just knowing the medium that you're working in is very useful.
The Girl with the Pearl Earring is probably a creepy movie. I haven't seen it. I mean, I liked it at the time, but it was years ago. But the scene I remember really loving was when they were making the paints. I don't know if you saw it, but they're looking at the sky and seeing what color the clouds really are, and they're crushing up different kinds of minerals to make paints. And I just thought, yeah, that's beautiful. And I don't know if fine artists are taught to do that today, but they should at least be exposed to, this is where your paint comes from. This is where the colors come from, I would think.
Yeah. I've never actually seen that movie, but yeah, I like that idea of just knowing, even if you never use it again, just knowing the medium in which you work with a little bit more intimately.
One of my favorite directors was Alfred Hitchcock, and his career, he started as an art director making title cards in the silent era, and he worked his way up and he did everything. He was a lighting designer, right? He eventually became a director, still in the silent era, and then he transitioned to sound, but by the time he was really a director of films, he had done every job. And so if people came to him and said, well, we can't really light this scene, he'd say, well, yes, you can. Here's how you do it. And I think, not to be a know-it-all, but just to understand all the background of the different skills. Where you work, well, you work in a distributed company, correct? You work at Slack. Is it distributed or do you go into an office?
I go into an office. We do have offices kind of all over the world, but yeah, our headquarters is in San Francisco. And so that's where I spend most of my time.
And you've been at Slack how long?
I just hit my 2-year mark.
Oh, wait. Okay. So after the election, basically.
Yeah, it's the job I took. I took some time off after the election to recover. But yeah, this was the job I took directly after that.
And did they reach out to you? Did you reach out to them?
It was a little bit of both. They were kind of on my radar since before the election, since before I took the job of the campaign, just because it was a tool that I had used for a while. We used it on the campaign, so I was kind of very familiar with the product. And it was a company that I was thinking about even while I was still working there, because working at a campaign, you do have the luxury of knowing that it's going to end. So people aren't shy about thinking about their next job prospects in general. So I was kind of thinking like, yeah, I'm not sure where I want to go, depending on how this turns out. But Slack seems pretty cool. So it was something that was in the back of my mind. And then, of course, when the election was over and I didn't start job hunting immediately, but I had people reach out to me. Slack was one of them. A former colleague of mine who worked there, she reached out to me directly and was like, you should definitely come work here. And so, yeah, they were probably one of my top companies before I even started looking, really.
And when I'm using Slack, what parts of it that I'm using, can I go, oh, Mina made this or Mina touched this? Like what specific things are you responsible for, I guess?
So strangely enough, if you're actually using the product, there is nothing in it that I can take any kind of credit for. I don't work on the product itself.
Okay.
I work on Slack.com. I work on pretty much anything that helps get new people into the Slack product, using the Slack product. So
onboarding?
Not even onboarding. Really, it's, I hate to use marketing terms, but it's probably the best way to say it. But like top of funnel stuff. So essentially getting people to make a new team, a new workspace on Slack. So it's more like educational materials and telling people what Slack is and how to use it and anything that can just sort of gain interest into the product.
Well, that makes sense because you're a speaker. So you're a teacher, you're an educator, you're associated with Girl Development and Black Girls Code. You're a lecturer all over the world. You just got back from where? From South Africa?
Yeah, I was in Cape Town doing a talk there.
At what, 5 planes, 6 planes?
It's actually easier to get there than to get back. I took 2 planes to get there and 4 to get back.
Why? What? It's like Hotel California. You can check in, but you can never leave.
A little bit. I planned my trip there to be as smooth as possible, just because I wasn't sure what it would be like. So I actually took some time in between my stops. So I went to London. I stayed there for a day, and then I went down to Cape Town. But on the way back, I just kind of flew directly home as directly as I could, and so it was kind of more. A little bit more hopping.
Well, from Cape Town to Oakland, I would think, yeah, there's... Well, let's see. I don't even know. What is the path?
Well, because of this particular event that I was at, it's called Pixel Up, which is a great event. And if anyone has a chance to go, they should. But cool. Pixel Up, what we did after the event was over was they actually took all the speakers who wanted to go on a safari trip. So when I left, I wasn't actually leaving from Cape Town. I was leaving from this smaller place in the Western Cape called George. And so I had to fly from George to Cape Town, then from Cape Town to Johannesburg, Johannesburg up to London, and then London back to SFO. So it was just more of a few more stops that I didn't anticipate.
London to SFO is direct. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a lot of direct flights out of SFO I'm finding. So it was really, really nice to be able to do that at least. Although some people who came back to SFO had a little bit less of a direct route, but fortunately I was able to make it a little bit more straight shot.
One of the things I love about, we both do a lot of traveling. And one of the things I love about living in New York is that there's a lot of direct flights. I have friends who live in other really beautiful places, And those places are wonderful and have a lot of advantages, but I'll think like, yeah, but man, I have a friend who lives in a place very happy, but they always have to take at least two flights. And I'm just like, I don't know. I'm just superstitious. I don't want to, you know, if the first plane gets me there, I don't want to get on another plane. Like I did my flying for today. I'm done.
Yeah, that is actually something I really miss about living in New York, because I lived there for almost 2 years. And yeah, you can get almost anywhere very easily. And that's something that I do envy.
And it's especially cruel if you live like right outside of New York, right? Although like Newark is really good. You can fly almost anywhere from Newark too, interestingly. You know, okay. In fact, half the direct flights to New York are really to Newark. So there's that. But when you moved around, was it driven by education, career, relationships? How did you move from place to place?
Oh, it was really driven by career for the most part. I don't think I've ever actually moved anywhere without it being driven by a job opportunity that I had. So I grew up in Kansas, Wichita, Kansas, to be exact. The first time I left there is when I went to school in Syracuse, New York, so in central New York. And I actually thought that I would stay in that part of the country. I thought I would stay on the East Coast, but didn't really pan out. So I went home, and I went home for a little bit, probably about 6 months, and I got a job working in Dallas, so I moved to Dallas.
I was going to say, when I called you today, Skype still thinks you're in Dallas.
Oh, it does? Oops. Yeah. That's okay. Clearly, I need to update everything.
Oh, man, that's we leave these trails. We leave these digital trails that are like I just took a new job, and I was like, oh, I've got to change that place, too. There's like hundreds of places where I've got the wrong job listing and all that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, a bunch of people kept pointing out to me that up until maybe a couple weeks ago, my website still thought I lived in Brooklyn. Like, I hadn't updated my own personal site.
So yeah, well, that's one of my favorite stories is that Ethan Marcotte's site was not responsive for like 5 years after he taught the world about it. He did like the first 20 responsive sites. Just not his own. He was too busy doing everybody else's. Right. I hope if Ethan hears this, he doesn't mind my saying that. It was just like, I thought, yeah, I totally get that. Of course, you're too busy to do your own. Like that's great. So
yeah, exactly. So I moved to Dallas.
Yeah, go ahead.
I moved to Dallas. I stayed there for 6 years. Then I moved to AT&T because I got a job at IBM. I moved to Austin because I got a job at IBM. Jesus, that did not sound
right.
So I moved from Dallas to Austin because I got a job at IBM Design. And I actually planned on staying there for as long as I could. But then I got the opportunity to go work for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And so I moved to Brooklyn 6 months after moving to Austin. And so I have not moved in a single place without it being driven by some kind of job opportunity.
Okay, that's remarkable. And when you grew up, were you in Kansas like the first 17 years of your life? And then since then, it's been move, or?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I lived in Kansas all of my, basically my entire childhood. And then when I went to college, I went away and essentially never came back except for that, you know, short stint.
You may have said this already, and I'm sorry if I blanked on it. Was it Wichita, Kansas City, a little town?
It was Wichita, which is actually the biggest city in Kansas because Kansas City is not in Kansas.
Right. Well, part of it is.
Yeah, that's true. But it's never the part that people are thinking of when they think of Kansas City.
It's a very confusing. And the first time, if you don't know that and you're not and you're flying to Kansas on business, that can be scary. Although Cincinnati is the scariest place I ever landed because they said, welcome to Kentucky.
And
Cincinnati's in Ohio. But you actually land in Cincinnati, Kentucky Airport, which is in Kentucky, and they don't say that when you land. They don't say, welcome to Cincinnati, Kentucky Airport, serving Ohio and Kentucky, which would be helpful for people like me who are vastly ignorant about geography. They just say, welcome to Kentucky, and I'm like, oh, my client's going to kill me. I took the wrong plane. Where's my bag? Did my bag make it? Where am I?
Yeah, that would freak me out too, because I did not know that at all.
Well, now you do, so that's cool. So if you work or speak in Cincinnati, you can anticipate that.
Cool.
And see. And what was you said you went to Pixel Up. What was this?
Yes.
And that was a great conference.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, you went on a safari. What was that like?
That was incredible. I've been wanting to go, for one, go to South Africa in general, but also go on a safari for, you know, at least a decade at this point. It's been like that aspirational trip I've had in my mind. So to actually do it was, you know, amazing. We spent 2 days on this this wildlife game reserve that has a vast variety of animals native to Southern Africa. It had the four of the what are called the big five animals. So it had let me see if I get this
lion,
right.
Lion, zebra, elephant.
Yeah, lion, zebra, elephant, water buffalo, and I think the leopard is the last of the big five. It did not have a leopard.
That's okay. So I mean, I'd love to look at them, but I wouldn't want to be like right around them.
Yeah, so I saw three of the big five. I didn't see any water buffalo, even though they had some on the reserve, but I did see a lot. I saw lions, I saw elephants, and I saw zebras. And I saw actually a lot of zebras. They were probably one of my favorite animals. I also saw giraffes, lots of antelope. I saw the white rhino, which I learned during that trip is going extinct. So that was kind of a bummer. I also saw hippos.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask.
Yeah, I saw, well,
hippos are amazing. I've seen hippos, only at a zoo, though, so it's not the same. But, yeah, they're amazing animals.
Yeah, I saw only, like, the top of them because they were in the water and they don't really come out until it's dark. But you kind of, I saw, like, the top of their little heads.
Did you see babies?
I don't know if there were any baby hippos in there or that I saw anyway. I think I just saw, like, a male and two females.
I saw a baby hippo in a zoo, maybe in Washington, D.C., but they're amazingly cute.
I would have liked to have seen them like out of the water, but our guide said, yeah, they're not going to come out till it's dark. So we won't see them.
And did you take any pictures? What did you do?
Oh, yeah. I took a lot of pictures. I took some mostly on my phone just because I didn't bring a camera with me, although I should have. But I was able to borrow someone else's camera for a while. So I did get some nice high quality photos as well. Oh, cool. But I took like hundreds of them.
And are they on your Instagram or anywhere? Flickr?
There's a few on my Instagram. I haven't finished putting them all up. But yeah, I usually put my travel photos up on Instagram just because that's where I like to share those kind of memories with people.
Right. Do you use Flickr? Did you ever use Flickr?
I used to use Flickr, but I don't anymore only because I tend to not take a lot of photos like I used to.
Yeah. Just because you got busy.
Yep.
How did you go from it? You know, when people don't know you and mm-hmm. When people haven't been with you the whole way on your career and nobody is, only you, it can seem like you just burst onto the scene and you were everywhere. But obviously that's not what happened. What were your first jobs like in this industry and how did you sort of find your voice?
I mentioned before that I'm completely self-taught and I spent the first 5 years of my professional career working as a production artist, actually. So I made, and I'm dating myself a little bit, but I spent my time making ads for the Yellow Pages. That's why I said I worked at AT&T before, which I don't know if anyone's ever seen, like if people remember what the Yellow Pages looked like. The ads are not, they're not
it's clip art-y.
Great works of design. So I was incredibly bored and frustrated the entire time, which is really how I kept getting more and more into doing web development because I needed something
I was working at an ad agency where I was under-challenged. I was being compensated, and that was good, but I could go into my office, close my door. People had offices and doors back then. Smoke. People smoked in their offices, but I don't smoke anymore, but people used to smoke, and they had private offices to do it in. And I could get my work done in an hour. And so I started freelancing very heavily. So I'd go into work and treat it almost like this is kind of shameful and sad, but early in my career. And so when the web came along, it was like pretty easy to spend part of the time on my job learning how to do this other thing. And at first I did it for my job. So I wasn't cheating or doing anything wrong. It's just that they didn't recognize the opportunity and go, wow, you should keep doing this. This is amazing. We can specialize in this. This can become a whole division for us. They were just like, yeah, that was a one-off. And I think nobody really got how big the web was going to be. Like, not many people got it.
I think so as well, because I actually tried to get AT&T to let me do more of that type of stuff. I wanted to move into a different department or something different to let me use the skill that I kept building. And because they didn't let me do that, I ended up moving on, and that's how I got my first couple of jobs in the web industry. I worked as a contractor for hire for probably the first year and a half. I did a bunch of 3-month stints jobs with local companies in Dallas just to get some experience doing web development and front development under my belt so I could start saying I actually had real jobs doing this type of work. So my first few jobs were working for a ad agency that's in Dallas where I helped build a bunch of sites for their clients. I did a stint working for a startup in Dallas where I worked for one of their big clients, Zales Jewelers. So that was my first startup experience where it was literally just me and the two founders working, and that was about it. Cool. And so I kind of did almost everything that the technical co-founder, the CTO, didn't do. So that was kind of really cool and interesting. And then I finally got my first full-time permanent job with this company that did sites for they did like financial sites for their clients that had for reimbursements or bug bounty programs or things like that. It was a lot of sites that handled financial transactions for third-party clients. So I built a bunch of templated sites for that. And it was after that particular job where I ended up meeting the recruiter who works for IBM Design. Yep. And I took my first, I guess, big leap into a real big tech company by moving down to Austin and working for IBM.
For 5 months.
Yes, for that's all of 5 months.
That's amazing. I did my first creative director job on the web, same exact thing, 5 months. At the end of 5 months, in my case, I wasn't happy. And I felt like it was at the end of the .com era, and everything was kind of crazy and out of control. And I just thought, this isn't sustainable, and I can do this work myself, and I'll charge less, but it'll all go to me, so it's fine. And that's what I did. And the company was out of business within a year. So I think I made the right move. But also, that's when I started HappyCog, which was my first agency. And it was really just me in my underwear working from home at the time. But I mean, 5 months was good. They said, stay one more month and you'll be vested. And I was like, no. I was like, when you know, when you're like, feel like this is it. And I think it sounds like IBM was that for you. And then immediately after IBM, the Clinton campaign was that for you. Like, how could you say no to that?
Yeah, I felt terrible leaving that job, but I picked up my life and moved down to Austin under the, idea that I would be there for a while. And I had no plans to leave. But yeah, when you get you get that opportunity handed to you, you're just like, well, I can't really say no to this.
Who did you talk to feel okay about it? Did you have a family member, a mentor, a friend, anybody that you could just say, hey, I'm conflicted. This is an amazing opportunity, but so is where I am right now. What do I do?
At the beginning, I didn't really talk to anybody because I actually was in talks with them before she had officially announced she was running. So it was a secret that I couldn't tell people just because, I didn't really want to be the one to leak to the world that she's going to do this thing. So, so for a while I didn't say much to anyone. I just was like, I have this opportunity that I'm thinking about and it's could be potentially really big, but I also, it could end up being over too soon. I was being very vague about details, but then when she actually announced she was running, I was like, okay, well, they want to hire me and I have an offer letter in hand and please help. I don't know how to go through this. And so I ended up talking to a bunch of people who worked on Obama's campaign. I didn't know them beforehand, but the person who was trying to hire me, Stephanie Hannon, who is the CTO of the Clinton campaign, she gave me a bunch of people who had done this before and said, you can ask them. Yeah. So like you can ask them for advice to see what their experience was like to help you kind of figure out what you're getting yourself into. And so I talked to, and I hope they don't mind me saying this, but I talked to the UX designer on the campaign, Manic, and I'm going to butchered her last name, so I'm not going to try to say it. I also talked to Harper, who was the CTO of Obama's campaign. Dan Ryan, who was the director of front end for Obama's campaign, he actually was the one who referred me to the job to work for the Clinton campaign. Wow. So I talked to all of them to see, like, what did this look like for you? What did this, what was this opportunity? What am I about to get myself into? And they all gave me some really great and, you know, direct advice and really, you know, frank advice. And essentially the one piece that stuck out for me the most was, for one, if you don't do this, will you regret it? But also, is this person, is this mission something you believe enough in to basically devote your life to it for the next 2 or so years? If the answer is no, you shouldn't do it. And so I sat with that for a while to figure out, is this something I feel like I can devote my life to for a while? And clearly the answer came up yes.
I want to hear more about that and talk about design systems and how you evolved to doing that and the work you do now. But before we do that, I want to take a quick commercial break to thank my sponsor. So mute or get a glass of water, whatever you need to do. I'm going to do a quick 20-second, 30-second read of my sponsor. Right. Okay, cool. This edition of The Big Web Show is brought to you by Blockstack. There's a better version of the internet, and it's already here. It's a decentralized one, free from data breaches, free from privacy abuses, where you own your identity and data. Blockstack is an open computing protocol that makes it easy for developers to build applications that guarantee their users' digital rights. Blockstack provides a stack of important layers developers can use so that people who use their apps truly own their data, own their identity, and even own their content and connections. These decentralized applications are more secure than traditional options. And with Blockstack, you make no sacrifices on performance or scalability. The blockchain-backed Blockstack ID allows users to safely and seamlessly engage with these applications and take back their online lives from data-hungry corporate giants. Blockstack is open source and free. Learning to build the future of the internet takes less than 60 minutes. Starting to use one of the many apps with your Blockstack ID takes just a few minutes. Developers, you can even get paid to build applications, better applications, using Blockstack via the app mining program. It's time to take back our digital rights. The Blockstack ecosystem is hard at work, and we'd love to have you. Learn more and get started at blockstack.org/bigwebshow. That's blockstack.org/bigwebshow. Thanks, Blockstack. And we are back with Mina Markham, a teacher in Oakland, California, involved in the tech community, teaching for Black Girls Code, founding the Dallas chapter of Girl Develop It and DFW SAS, presenting at various conferences, including the Front End Design Conference, Midwest.io, Distill, Pixel, and Event Apart. You're at Event Apart next month in Boston? Yes?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, and she's the co-owner or co-organizer of Front Porch, your own conference, a conference on front-end web technologies for developers, designers, entrepreneurs, and managers. She is also best known for before we go back to Clinton, the Clinton campaign, what's Sassy Starter, which is something that you've made? What's Sassy Starter?
Oh, yeah. So the Sassy Starter is this open source project that I have there. Essentially, it's a website starter kit that I made up based on my own preferences that I then open source for other people to use as a jumping off point to make a static website on the static website, essentially. So it uses Sass as a CSS preprocessor, and it includes a recommended structure that I use for the sites that I build.
Smax.
It actually is, it uses Smax. It's a bit of Smax. It's a bit of it's kind of a combination of a bunch of different methodologies. It's just something that it makes sense to me the way to organize my CSS structure. And I thought it would be useful to other people. And so far it seems like people have been using it. It's been forked a few times and people have told me that they have been using it. So I think it is helpful, but
and it's on GitHub, so people can use it or they can fork it. Just like you said, it's not a framework.
No, it really is essentially just a bunch of blank files and folder structures. It really is an unopinionated sort of starter kit for your website needs, I guess, essentially. But yeah, it doesn't provide any code, so to speak. It's more like a idea of how to structure your web project.
And then the documentation looks like it's a pattern library.
I think I use SAS docs to document it actually. Okay. I don't include any actual CSS or any actual styling, but I do include a bunch of helper SAS functions and mixes to help make your development easier.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, I am kind of famously not a big fan of frameworks. I get why people use them. I understand that people are under terrible pressure. Most people at their jobs are based on how much they make, not how good it is or what customer needs they solve, which is what it should be, but on did you make 10 things, you should have made 12 things, right? That's a pressure that most developers and designers are under. And so of course frameworks help with that. But to me, the best projects are bespoke. You sort of figure out what are we trying to say? Who are we making this for? What is it supposed to do? And then you write code and design experiences that do that and nothing else. So I get that. And I appreciate that you made a starter kit, but it's not a framework, not knocking anybody who makes frameworks, not knocking anybody who uses them, but I like this approach better. And pantsuit. Did Hillary Clinton know that you called it pantsuit?
People ask me that a lot. And honestly, I don't know. She was aware that I'm not sure if she was aware that the pattern library or design system existed as its own thing. She was obviously aware of the website. I showed her the website when she came to visit the office. It's actually one myth that people seem to think that she was around the campaign office a lot. And she really wasn't. She came, I could count on my hand how many times she actually was there. But in one time she was there, I was giving the job of demoing the site for her. And so she was aware that the site clearly existed and what it looked like, but I don't know if she was aware of what we call the underlying pattern library that built it.
And kind of why would she be? She's not a web developer. She doesn't need to know that.
Yeah. I mean, somebody might've mentioned it at some point, but yeah, I honestly have no idea.
How did you, whose idea was it to do a pattern library, to do a design system, as opposed to let's make a website for Hillary?
It was actually my boss's idea, Kyle Rush, who was the director of front end and then later the deputy CTO of the campaign. One of the first things he challenged me with was he's like, we need some kind of bootstrap. We need some kind of pattern library, some kind of framework to make our development go faster. He knew this because he actually had worked on the Obama campaign before. So he had done this before and he knew what kind of tools needed to be in place early on. And I was one of the first engineers in the office, and he knowing as little as he did about my skill set, I'm actually still to this day shocked that he trusted me to do this, because he essentially said, we need some kind of bootstrap. Do you think you can do it? And I said, yes. And then he just left me to my devices to do it, which was amazing. And so I kind of went away and figured out, okay, well, what does a pattern library, what does a design system kind of look like? Like at this stage for this kind of project.
And you worked on them before? Had you worked on them at IBM or at the Dallas ad agency or?
I worked on it a little bit at IBM. The product team that I was on at IBM, that was one of the projects I was starting to do, but I hadn't actually finished it by the time I ended up leaving. So I, at that point, had never actually completed one. So it was, I guess I should say that it was a sort of, for I don't want to say it was a miracle that I got it done, because it wasn't. It was a culmination of my skills. But when I went into it, I actually didn't know what the completed product should or would look like.
So it was very gutsy of you to say yes.
And I guess so. Yeah.
But that's my favorite internet story. All my favorite internet stories are that same story of they asked me, could I do this? And either I had no idea what I was doing, but I said yes, or I'd been exposed to something like it a little bit before, so I said yes. But in any case, I mean, I think one of the, for me, what keeps this field always interesting and always challenging is that we constantly have to make stuff we've never made before and learn things we haven't learned. And there's always some new, better way or potentially better way of doing something, but we have to learn. There's constantly a learning curve. And I think if you have to be the kind of person that can go, okay, I'll try this. Otherwise, I don't know how long you can last in this business. But the fact that you did that for Hillary Clinton for like a presidential campaign, that's very, very gutsy. So thanks.
Yeah. I look back on it and it was a lot. It was bold of me to be like, yeah, I could totally do this. And I think it definitely was. I still will thank Kyle to this day because he did show a lot of trust and faith in me without really having any proof that it would be warranted. So thank you.
I have imposter syndrome and I've been doing this for 25 years. I think you've written about imposter syndrome to some extent. Do you have it? And if so, how bad is it?
I have it on and off for actually pretty much since I started working in this field. Strangely enough, as I get more and more, I guess, known, my imposter syndrome actually becomes even worse. So you would think that as I gain more experience and confidence, it would go down. But no, it really just kind of gets a little bit worse. I think the worst bout of imposter syndrome I had was actually when I stood on stage at Event Apart, where I had you and Eric Meyer and Jen Simmons and Rachel Andrew like staring at me and just like, these are people I've learned from and now I have to like talk about the stuff that they basically taught me. God, crap. It happens to me quite a bit. Just sort of depends on, I guess, the scenario I happen to be in. But yeah, as I start trying to tell people more and more about the things that I've learned, I sometimes have this thought of, why you don't really know what you're talking about. Why, who are you to teach anyone how to do anything? So it's still there.
I have that all the time. Occasionally I have the opposite. Occasionally I'll have this arrogant, don't you know who I am moment, which is, not great. But it's very rare. Almost always I feel, and people will say, you're so humble. I'm like, no, you don't realize how scared I am because I'm never sure I know what I'm talking about. To me, I'm still figuring this stuff out. But I think that's actually a really good thing. Most of the people I know who I know are talented, like you, who I know have done things like you, I say the same thing and I'm like, okay, I'm in good company, right? Because other people who I know what they're doing. I believe. I could hand them an assignment and they would fulfill it very well. They say, geez, I don't really know. I'm kind of scared. So I think that's okay. And I think that's a better problem to have than a belief in your own infallibility. Like, I'm going to go to the moon because I'm a billionaire, right? With the headset. I was just reading a really great article about, on the anniversary of Apollo 11, when America sent astronauts to the moon, but really when humanity went to the moon, it wasn't about America. And there was this beautiful sentence, which I just retweeted. I'm blanking on the author's name. I'll think of it in a minute. It was a really wonderful article, but she said that there used to be rooms full of cigarette smokers who were really good at math, who could send humans to the moon and back without even one slide presentation by an egocentric billionaire in a headset. And I just loved that so much because it's sort of, one thing that was great in the past that we sort of miss now. Anyway, long-winded way of saying, I think being a little nervous about your ability keeps you on your toes and is a good thing. Wow, that was a really long-winded way of saying that. I'm sorry. My daughter says I'm monologue.
Okay.
You know, like in the Invincibles. The Awesomes.
I have not actually seen that movie.
But that's not called The Invincibles. What is it? The Awesomes, the Fantastics.
Oh, The Incredibles?
The Incredibles, yeah.
Yes. The monologue. Yes, I have seen that. I love that movie.
Yeah. That was the best thing in that movie was they made monologue a verb or an adverb or whatever. And
yeah,
I do that. It's sad. I'll end up in a mental hospital just talking to myself. And,
oh, no.
I know, it's okay. I'll enjoy my speeches. But thanks. Back to you. Back to you. Okay. You're an INFP in Oakland, California. What is that?
Yeah. If you subscribe to the Myers-Briggs personality test, and I know not everybody does, and they may have been debunked or whatever. Anyway, it means I am, let me see if I can remember this, a intuitive, introverted, feeling, and perceptive. Essentially, it's a shorthand way of letting people know the kind of personality that they're going to get when they talk to me. No one ever believes me when I say this because I do a lot of speeches and am kind of public about a lot of things, but I'm very introverted. I find being around a large group of people very exhausting, but I can do it. I just need to be left alone after I do it. So that's just really a shorthand way of me to tell people, hey, I tend to be a little quiet when you meet me. It's not because I don't like you. It's just because I am processing and don't always have something to say.
That makes sense. And I'm not quiet, but I have the rest of that. Like when I love an event apart and I'll go, I can't wait to see all my friends and have dinner with them after the show. By the time 6 o'clock rolls around, I'm like, I'm going to my room and sleeping. And because my brain is full and my emotions are full. And I just need like 10 hours to lie down. I know that's weird, but it recharges me.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what happens. Sometimes I will kind of disappear when I've been around people for a while. Like I'll just kind of like slowly like back away and leave the room because it's just like I need a few moments to myself because there's just a lot going on.
I leave parties that way too. When I make myself go to them, which is hard. But if I go to the party, the chances are I'm not going to be the polite person who says, thank you so much. It was great. I'll just be like, I'll disappear and hopefully you won't even remember that I was there. It's just a thing. So yeah. I get it. It's okay. So what's your favorite kind of vacation then?
I usually travel alone just because I, being an introvert, I actually like being alone quite more than most people do. But my favorite vacations are when I go to a city that I do enjoy going to cities more than I enjoy going to like sort of the out of the way places, just because I like to joke that in my semi old age, I like comfort. And yeah. So I like a certain level of comfort when I go travel, which means I generally stick to places that have modern conveniences.
Yeah.
But I love going to, it sounds like a cliche, but I really do enjoy going to museums, particularly museums that have works of like great works of art. I didn't do any kind of minor or anything, but if I had, it would have been art history. And when I studied abroad in London, I actually took art history courses. So I love going to these museums that have all these pieces to be able to see them up close. Probably my favorite city in the world is Florence, just because the city itself it feels like a work of art, but it also has, it's home to like a lot of great masterpieces. Of course, the Michelangelo's David is there, but also Uffizi Gallery, which has some beautiful, beautiful pieces in it. And I spent hours in that gallery just staring at all the works of art there. I also just love Italy, like in the Italian culture, and particularly Italian food. Like I really do love Italian food.
Yep.
So I was probably, I've been to Italy, I think at this point, 4 times.
Oh, wow.
And I really, really love that country so much. And so that's probably like my favorite vacation spots are in that vicinity, in Tuscany in particular, just because it gives me a lot of the cultural, a lot of the cultural richness that I like, I guess is the best way to put that.
It's funny. I honeymooned in Rome. I basically just went out looking at art all day long, and by 4 PM had to go back to the hotel and lie down for a few hours, not because it was a honeymoon, but just because, again, being around that much art was like being around a whole bunch of exciting, interesting people. It's energizing, and then it completely enervates you. It's like I was wiped out. I was like, oh my God. I felt like I couldn't go to a urinal without Michelangelo's David being next to it. Like everywhere I went, there was some amazing masterpiece of art that I'd grown up seeing in books, and there it was. And then there was the architecture. And then, you know, you could sit down and have an amazing espresso and then get up and look at more of it. And I loved that, but it also, yeah, basically, so my theme, I think I'm a lot older than you, and my theme is basically old age wears me out. I love to go to museums too, and then like, oh, this is great. And then like, okay, now I have to have a coffee and then lie down. Do you drink coffee and then lie down? You ever do that?
I don't drink coffee generally because I'm very sensitive to caffeine. And so I usually only drink coffee when I actually need the jolt of caffeine. I do enjoy drinking. I drink a glass of wine. Usually not a lot, but if I were to drink something and lie down, it would be probably a nice glass of white wine. And then I would take a nap or something.
That sounds good. I used to take a nap after a huge meal, which is just wrong in every way, but there's something incredibly decadent and like almost like a Roman orgy, but like without you, with just food, just like, that was a lot of wonderful pasta. Now I will sleep and just let the food. I won't use the energy of the food at all. I'll just lie and bask in it. I don't know. It's kind of creepy, but okay. Sorry. I'm taking some strange turns here today on the Big Web Show. Hey, come for the web design, stay for the weird pasta fantasy.
I love
okay.
it.
Are you planning on writing a book at any point, or just that's not something you want to do?
It is something that's I am thinking of, and it's something that is it's in the works. It's just me being kind of slow on pulling the trigger. But yeah, it's definitely in my brain.
Cool. And would it be about?
It would probably be about design systems, which is something that I have a good expertise in. But I just don't know exactly what area I would want to talk about, like how I wanted to approach the topic, because it's a very, you know, large topic, and there's lots of information about it out there already. So I just need to figure out exactly how I want to frame it.
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, that's hard. Our whole industry now, there's so much information about everything, but still your take and your experience are really valuable, right? People sometimes say, I can't blog because anything I want to write about, somebody else has written about it. Yeah, and they always will.
To go back to what you say about your posture surgeon, that actually is probably a big factor in what has been in me trying to figure out how I want to approach this particular challenge of writing a book, because it feels like, well, again, who am I to write, you know, a book on this subject? You know, am I really an authority? And again, thinking about, well, people have written about this before, people who have more experience doing this kind of thing than me. So it becomes hard to get over that voice of doubt in your own mind to let you do something and take that next step.
You know what I find helpful? I think of the web not as a collection of authorities, but as a community, and we're all just figuring it out. And some people are just motivated to share what they've learned. They're not saying they're an expert or they're an authority. And by the way, you said earlier that the better known you get, the harder, the worse your imposter syndrome is. I've also found that the better known I get, the harder it is for me to say, I don't know how to do that. I make a point of saying it, but it's hard. People don't believe it. I was taking a test at my new job, and they said, like, rate your own skills because that's something they make everybody do. And I gave myself a 3 out of 5 in CSS, and they were like, that's ridiculous. You can't, and you wrote the book on it. And I'm like, yeah, I wrote a book 10 years ago. Yeah, 3's kind of generous, actually. And I'm like, I know Eric Meyer and Rachel Andrew and Jen Simmons, like, believe me, 3 is generous. And they're like, okay, well, you're being humble. And I'm like, I'm really not. I'm actually aware of how much there is to know. And they might give themselves 3s or 4s, right? For all I know, they might say there's more that I don't know. So I think if you don't try to be an expert, if you're just one of the people that's doing work and people are noticing your work and you want to share what you're learning, it gives you permission to write. At least that's what I tell myself, if that helps. I don't know.
Yeah, that does help. It's just have to kind of get past this idea that I'm not good enough to do something and just go out there and do it.
Well, I mean, you've clearly shown over and over again that you very much are, and you make a big point of encouraging other people, which is a great and amazing. And one of the signs that you belong out there teaching, the fact that you bring other people along, you're not cutting off the ladder behind you. You're extending a ladder. You're extending your sharing. So to me, it's just another way. And you don't have to write a book. There's lots of other things you could do, but writing a book, if you choose to do it, it's just another way of sharing what you know in a way that's like storable.
Yeah. It's definitely something I want to do. It's something that I hope will definitely happen, but yeah, so one of those hurdles I have to get over is just essentially, you know, get over myself and do it.
Cool. Well, if you ever want to talk about that or anything else, I hope we'll talk again. We're coming up on our hour. This hour to me has flown by. I always love talking to you, and it always seems to be really fun and move really quickly. You're Mina Markham. People can find you on GitHub. You're Mina Markham, all one word. On LinkedIn, you're Mina Markham. On Twitter, you're at Mina Markham. You're Mina.codes on the web. And all these notes and more will be in the show notes when the show goes live. So Mina, thank you for giving us this time today. I really appreciated it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. I hope we'll do it again soon.